are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 9th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, reporter Christopher Leonard on his book, Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. Also on the program today, Trump invited the Taliban to Camp David in a failed, rushed peace deal gambit. Betsy DeVos unveils new rules to protect fraudulent for-profit colleges. Democrats to launch a broader corruption investigation into the Trump administration as formalization of impeachment inquiry begins. All this as Congress returns and face a government shutdown within 3 weeks. The Air Force is now probing a rash of Trump resort overnight stays by Air Force personnel. And a big special election in North Carolina tomorrow. Can the Democrats steal a heavily Republican seat? Donald Trump headed down there to make sure that doesn't happen. We'll see if that backfires. And on the eve of the Democratic debate, Joe Biden, to the extent that he can, hears footsteps. The MIT Media Lab, rocked by Jeffrey Epstein controversy.
You know what Joe Ito, the director of the Media Lab, tweeted in 2008?
The former one.
The former one.
Yeah.
He tweeted, "Don't take money from a-holes."
Right. There you go. He either had a real trouble with assessments of a-holes or that he had a change of heart. Republican gerrymander godfather, turns out, used race-based analysis in his work for North Carolina, among other places. And we wondered why the Republicans weren't going to pursue that ruling last week. Now we know, ladies and gentlemen. And lastly, well, not lastly. And the Department of Justice is weaponized in the automaker investigation. And you've heard of disaster capitalism. Now we have disaster fascism as we refuse to take in refugees from Bahamas. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Jamie is out today. We'll probably be back tomorrow. Everybody else is here with bells on. Another week. Congress is back. We are officially in the political season, as it were. We've got a big Democratic debate tonight. This week, I should say. We have a big Democratic Republican race in North Carolina. The North Carolina race is really one of those things that's just going to give us, it doesn't mean much in practice. Why people are looking to it is because it's an indication of just how dramatic Donald Trump's bleeding is. North Carolina, too, is about a week away now, maybe a week and a half away from a deadline which was imposed upon them by a superior court to redraw their districts. And Republicans are not contesting this. I would argue it's probably because of these revelations that they must have had a heads up about by the guy who had drawn the maps for them. This is the famous guy. We talked about him a lot in the context of the census question. This guy, Hofeller, who apparently, and now these documents are out, would give lessons to state legislatures on how to redraw maps using his data, and literally told them never, ever use email. No one can see this stuff. And apparently he thought he was going to live forever and that his strange daughter would not comb through his things and give up the ghost and reveal all of this in literally gigabytes of documents that she found. So a fascinating turn of events, and we'll see. It's going to have broader implications. It could have implications at the Supreme Court, although I imagine they're not going to revisit these cases. Remember, the Supreme Court will weigh in on gerrymanders that are racially based, but they won't. They say they can't. They don't know how to do it on a partisan basis. Now, state courts have shown they can do it on a partisan basis. But if it comes out that all of the contested districts that we've been talking about for years in these cases were undergirded by a racial analysis, it's going to have some broader implications. And to a certain extent, it's hard to imagine they couldn't. When you think about the states that we're talking about, and you think about the fact, simply the fact, there's one party in America that is all white, that is based around an identity of whiteness. That is the Republican Party. That's simply a fact. They talk about identity politics. The reason why they don't have to talk about identity politics, they only have one identity. The Democratic Party is made up of white people and black people and Latino people and Asian people. And if you're going to try and figure out how to give Republicans the advantage in many of these states, and you want to maximize it, chances are you're probably using race as a factor. And that's certainly what this guy did. So that's a big deal, this race in North Carolina, the debate coming up. There's data showing that Biden, or at least stories that we're hearing, that even in Bidenville, people are a little worried. Do not think that his lead is terribly durable. I think if you look at some of the stuff coming out about Warren that you see, whether it moves you or not, I think a lot of that's coming from the Biden camp. Ed Rendell going and saying that I had Elizabeth Warren at a fundraiser a year ago. She had no problem with the big money that we have now. She only has a problem with it now. Two different ways of looking at that. One is she was doing big money a year ago. The other is she's no longer doing big money. So, but nevertheless, Ed Rendell is not out there fighting for anybody but Joe Biden. Part of that old man, white guy club that wants to reach those people in the suburbs. Is this just a picture of Hofeller? Yeah. All right. Well, let's... since we're talking about odious people, what do you do if you you can't rerun for mayor because you participated in, you've crapped all over your citizenry in many respects? You have participated, possibly. People seem to think he did. I don't know how he couldn't have, but it's possible, I guess, that he was completely hoodwinked by everything that went down with the Laquan McDonald case. And if you were the guy who said, you know, F the left, let's destroy all the outside agitation during the Obama administration. If you were the weak-kneed guy in the Obama administration, right? Like if they look around the room, they're like, who's the first guy to retreat from any, taking any advantage of the destruction that George W. Bush left in his wake? The first guy to retreat, it was this beautifully tanned and coiffed jackass.
The risk you said, which is appropriate and it measures up, is...
Oh, I should tell people, because that's probably not in his official title. Rahm Emanuel, folks. Here he is.
Healthcare is a single issue that Democrats have a 35-point advantage on. President Trump is trying to do everything he can to narrow that down. We've taken a position so far, and the candidates have, through the process, a few have not, about on basically Medicare for All, which is we're going to eliminate 150 million people's health care, and we're going to provide health care for people that just come over the border. That is an untenable position for the general election. As you know, George, I just biked around Lake Michigan, nearly 1,000 miles, through Michigan and Wisconsin, two really important states. Nobody at a diner ran at me and said, take my health care away. Nobody. This is reckless as it relates to, and you don't have to take the position to win.
Pause
the primary.
I wonder how many people ran up to him at a diner and just said, hey, you're an a-hole.
Or had no idea who the hell he was, if they were lucky.
Right.
Position to win the primary, and you're basically literally hindering yourself for the general election.
But to the governor's point, I mean, there is a question about whether this comes down to electability and this return to stability that Biden is running on, or whether voters want someone like Warren who's going to shake up the whole system. And when you look at our poll, particularly, it shows that there is this boost for Biden because of the electability argument.
Yeah, first of all, there's so much with that exchange that is just sort of stunning. Now, of course, you know, when Chris Christie is, you know, when Rahm Emanuel is supposedly bringing up the left here on this panel, this is the conversation that you're going to get. It is impossible to find in this country, in our history, an example of a presidential candidate who came out with a proposal that was in any way unpopular and wrote it to the White House. You cannot find it in history except for the last presidential election, where just about every proposal that Donald Trump offered had a net negative perspective with polling. So just that frame itself is just absurd. And again, and this is going to be the theme that we're going to hear about, or you're going to hear about, because I'm going to keep talking about it for the next 12 months. The model that these old idiots are using, this idea that there are people out there, voters, who lean Democrat and lean Republican, and sometimes they vote Republican and sometimes they vote Democrat, that model is done. Surely you can find those people. There are some of them. But this is all about return on investment and opportunity cost. Those two dynamics. The data shows that in purple districts in 2018, where people ran towards the center as a Democrat, they lost. And the reason is because Republicans are getting record-breaking turnout. And so Democrats need to have record-breaking turnout. The way to get record-breaking Democratic turnout is not to cut against polarization, but to not worry about polarization and provide things that animate Democratic voters and lean Democratic voters. There are not voters staying home saying, I think these policies are too far to the left, at least on the Democratic side. They're just saying, does this impact me enough? And that could be material and it could be an emotional impact. But they are predisposed to everything that the Democratic base is predisposed to. They just need to know that it's actually going to impact them. It needs to impact them in some way. So when you talk about immigration, how much does it motivate the people there? We know from data that the question of immigration in the wake of the Donald Trump election, the left is far more energized by it than they were during the Obama administration. Without a doubt, it became an issue in many ways in the same way that what happened with right-wing voters, where everything became racialized. So too for the left. It's just that they now support these things in a more polarized fashion. You want to bring more people out, you hammer those things. You're not going to depress your turnout by supporting things that marginal voters don't necessarily want. They're just waiting for things that are going to push them out, that are going to motivate them to get up. And electability and shaking things up are not diametrically opposed. These are not opposites. You have to go all the way back to 2016 to see that they're not diametrically opposite. Because it turns out that the guy who was promising to shake things up won.
Incidentally, it's obviously a self-selected audience, but the greatest applause line we had after celebrating David Koch's death at our live show in Chicago was definitely roasting Rahm Emanuel.
Yes.
People, and a lot of folks in Chicago beyond that room, if you look at polls,
right,
really hate him.
Right. Right. And which is why he is up there representing Democrats on ABC television. I mean, it's sort of fascinating. I mean, it's like sort of the Claire McCaskill.
It's the same. It's precisely
same exact
thing.
Dynamic.
30% with the voters of Chicago, 80% with ABC
right.
brass.
Right. There it is. And we could probably spend 6 months trying to delve into what creates that dynamic. But that's just the reality. Meanwhile, we have two sponsors today, both of which I use on a regular or semi-regular basis. Which one do you think I use on the regular basis, and which one do you think I use on the semi-regular basis?
Fun game.
One is a toothbrush, one is Blinkist.
Blinkist.
No, I use...
Definitely Blinkist.
Well, first off, I don't know when it was. Maybe it was about 3 or 4 years ago. Just completely coincidentally, I got very, very obsessed with my dental hygiene. I just got very obsessed with it because I started becoming aware that, like, I'm not that far out from having dental issues, and I just got obsessed by it. I read about it and this and that. Turns out toothpaste, it's good for you to use for your breath, but that's not the key. The key to maintaining good dental hygiene, and this is crucial, not just for your dental health, but your entire health. A lot of research is starting to suggest that, like, you know, things start in your mouth and they end in your heart. And I started getting into the idea of an electric toothbrush, and I tried to get an electric toothbrush, but then I had to plug it in. I left it on the counter of the sink. We only had one bathroom in my house. We had multiple people in there. The thing would fall, and then it's dirty. Then I don't want to deal with it. And then it's heavy. I couldn't travel with it. And then one day Quip becomes a sponsor, and it is an electric toothbrush that is more or less the same size as your normal toothbrush. It is beautifully styled, does not need to be charged every night. It's created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, which is healthier habits. Like, you got to brush your teeth every day. And you got to do it when you travel and you can't get out of the rhythm. And Quip has a built-in timer to make sure that you do it for the full 2 minutes that you're supposed to do it. Meanwhile, it has a service where it delivers you the dentist-recommended new brush head every 3 months, the new charge for your phone. It has a travel cap that doubles as a thing that you stick onto your mirror, and you can hang it right there. It's not cumbersome. It's not going to fall over the place. It doesn't matter if you have a small, you know, thing around your sink. I've ordered a kid's Quip for Saul. He's super psyched. We're going to be doing this together. Quip starts at just $25. You get the first refill at quip.com/majority. You will get it for free. This is a simple way to support the program and your dental hygiene. Go to getquip.com/majority to get your first refill free. That's getquip.com/majority to get your first refill free. And folks, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't have time to read a lot of the self-help books that I want to learn terms like return on investment and 80-20 dynamics.
80-20 dynamics.
Exactly.
Love it.
Exactly.
Stoked.
And if you are like me and don't feel like you have the time to read all the books that are on your list, well, Blinkist is an app that has made your day, your life a little bit easier. It compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed into 15 minutes that you can either read or listen to on the app. It's unique. It works on your phone. It works on your tablet. Works on your web browser. You'll find everything from health and self-help titles to history and business books included in Blinkist Library. You can, check out The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. That's my favorite. That's basically what I'm trying to do. Trying to get there. I can't, you know, obviously we do 2.5-hour show every day, but I'm going through, I'm listening to like the 7 Habits. I'll be honest with you. In a million years, I would never pick up the 7 highly effective habits of effective people. I would never do it.
I believe you.
But you know what? 15 minutes to listen to it? All right. Sure. If I walk away one effective habit.
Let's see what you have to say, Steve.
Exactly.
Come on, Mr. Covey. Hit me with motivation.
The Fire and Fury. You want the key takeaways about how insane the Trump White House is? Boom. There's a lot of stuff like that. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. You get all the books you want, one low price. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Christopher Leonard. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program business reporter and author of Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. Christopher Leonard, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The book is gotten wild reviews, and Jane Mayer, who wrote a book about the dark money and the Koch brothers, says that if there was any question as to the role of the Koch brothers in the climate denial movement in this country that your book basically puts it to rest, which is pretty amazing praise from someone who spent so much time working on the Koch brothers. I want to get to that, but let's just start with and obviously it's we recently lost one of the Koch brothers. We will get to that as well. Obviously, David Koch has passed away. But let's just start with the title. It's a Kochland. It's a double entendre of sorts. Do tell.
That's exactly right. First of all, Kochland describes this institution really well and in really surprising ways. You know, quickly, this company has been led by one person for over 50 years. Charles Koch has been CEO of this institution since 1967, when Lyndon Johnson was president. I don't know of any organization in private sector that has had one leader for that long. Charles Koch has a very particular philosophy about how to structure corporations and, frankly, how to structure all of American society. And he teaches all of his employees this philosophy called market-based management. And it's no exaggeration. People who work for Koch speak their own language. They have their own vocabulary. They have their own whole way of seeing the world. So that's why it's Kochland. But the reason I wrote the book and the reason I was attracted to this is that this one company helps us understand so much about what's going on in America today, economically and politically. The reason is that Koch Industries, this company, it's embedded in our daily life. I mean, this is a massive company with annual sales bigger than that of Facebook, Goldman Sachs, and U.S. Steel combined. And it specializes in these businesses that you need to survive: fuel, fertilizer, clothing material, building material, the sensors in our phones and computers. Koch makes all of these things. And so when you write about Koch, you really are writing about the entire spectrum of the American economic experience, from blue-collar manufacturing workers to high finance derivative traders to private equity deal makers. It's all there in this one institution.
And we should say that I guess the argument is it's not just that from a product standpoint they have embedded themselves in within American life, but they obviously have in a political sense. I mean, I've been talking about the Koch brothers probably for 15 years, and it's sort of fascinating because on some level they've been siloed, you know, but they have more money than Gates. They have more, they do more business, like you say, than all these other companies combined. They're so massive. Yet in some ways they've always been sort of like, it's almost like, you know, when I talk about Bill Gates in the context of education, right, it's not even remotely controversial, the impact that Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation, had on education policy for 10 years in this country. But yet it has been, and you know, your book is part of changing this, I think, but this sort of notion of like, oh, to talk about the Koch brothers and their influence is, you know, sort of like, it's marginal and almost, you know, almost conspiracy theory laden. But the fact of the matter is, there's no entity that has a greater single influence probably on our country.
Well, there are a couple things going on here, and I agree with you totally. And first of all, this story of Koch is very reflective of what's going on. They are there. Okay, you talk about politically. Let's get to that. One of the big things I wanted to talk about this in this book is corporate power and corporate influence over our public policy, literally our laws and our public life. Corporations have more power today in America than they've had in 100 years, since the Gilded Age, the robber baron era. And so in so many important ways, we are back there again. And Koch Industries is the poster child of this, but it's also a driver of it, as you say. Yes, they reflect these big trends in corporate influence, but they drive them as well. Charles Koch has built a political influence machine that is unrivaled by any in corporate America. And I say that sincerely. And I'm a business reporter, but you look at Walmart, General Electric, Lockheed Martin, they all lobby. They've got big lobbying shops. Charles Koch's built something totally different. It's like this 360-degree political influence machine that has, at its heart, one of the biggest registered lobbying operations in America. But then you couple with that a donor network that Charles Koch put together that raises more money in some election cycles than an actual political party does. Then you've got this constellation of Koch-funded think tanks, a kind of mainstream Charles Koch's very libertarian anti-government ideas. And finally, one of the pieces that really sets it apart is this nationwide activist group called Americans for Prosperity that is Koch-built and Koch-controlled. It's in almost all 50 states, I believe. And that's where you get people knocking on doors. Americans for Prosperity will fill charter buses full of angry voters and deliver them right to the doorstep of the lawmakers that Koch's lobbying shop has targeted to be pressured. So taken together, you see a corporate influence machine that is just really powerful. And when Koch sets that thing against issues it cares about, it truly does win a majority of the time. It gets its policy preferences on climate change regulation, taxes, environmental regulation, you name it.
Can we just add to that too? I haven't seen as much reported about this in a couple of years, but they basically have a more robust national political operation than the Republican Party, like literally in terms of like the voter files that they maintain. Is that still operative? We just don't hear about it as much, but this their ability to say, you know, all the assets you need to run as a Republican, we provide that for you better than the Republican Party does.
Without question. Now, one thing we need to get to, there's no question the Republican Party is drifting from the libertarian free market Koch vision because of Trump, okay? But you are exactly right that Koch has built this nationwide infrastructure that rivals and at times surpasses the actual Republican parties. And, okay, here's what's fascinating to me. I'm really fascinated with the corporation itself. The most mind-blowing element of this whole corporate empire is the financial trading desks. Koch has built a global network of commodities trading desks that rivals anything on Wall Street. Why am I talking about that right now? Because the way Koch trades commodities has informed the way it affects our politics. These commodities traders are deep analysts who suck in tons of information, and they know the system, okay? When these commodities traders are betting on oil, they're betting on like the nuts and bolts mechanics, that the price of oil at the Gulf Coast is going to go up against the price of oil in the Northeast. Really complicated stuff. Koch approaches politics in the same way. It has built a map of American political power that's like a map of a big pipeline network, if you will. They're looking at state legislatures. They're looking at the court system. They're looking at the United States Congress. They're looking at the administrative agencies like OSHA, EPA. They're down there in the actual pipes where lawmaking is happening, where legislation is happening, and that's where Koch is influencing things. So yeah, they've built a nationwide effort that really rivals any political parties.
All right, let's go back for a bit and step back and look at the way that the company grew, starting with Fred Koch, who famously, made his first big cash working with the Nazis and the Soviets. I mean, he was willing to do business, Fred Koch was.
Yes, and I got, so Fred Koch, the story he tells his family is he went over and did business with Stalin and after doing it for a while realized the horrors of communism and came back home and tried to fight communism. But this guy, Fred Koch, who started this company, was a millionaire, industrialist, real driving personality, and a hardcore right-wing conservative. Fred Koch was one of the co-founders of the John Birch Society, which was this secretive right-wing group that literally believed the federal government had been infiltrated by communists and that these New Deal programs Americans kind of relied on were sort of a Trojan horse for communist tyranny. And so I think what Fred Koch imparted to his four sons was a view that politics and economics are not separate things. They're the same strand of DNA intertwined with each other. And that's why you see Charles Koch, who's Fred's son that eventually took over the corporate empire and CEO today, Charles Koch from the beginning has been very active in politics because he understands that public policy in Washington really affects how economics and corporations work in a very fundamental way, which is why he's been so focused on corporate lobbying. So I think Fred Koch passed on to his sons a very anti-government point of view that truly, I mean, Charles Koch, you look at the memos involved in his think tanks and the speeches he gives, there's a not just a skepticism of government, but a disdain and a true loathing of government programs, which they consider to always create more problems than they solve.
One of the things that I, as I look at this, and I want to get through, you know, I want to talk about their role in climate, in the Tea Party, and cap and trade, and a couple of the other examples that you use, Pine Bend, in Minnesota. But this dynamic, I mean, one of the things that I've understood in terms of what came from Mount Pelerin, which was sort of the nascent beginnings of a libertarian philosophy, was that in fact it wasn't just simply about the free market; it was about controlling the government apparatus to set up specific players in the industry. I mean, because and as I've experienced it, you know, through the years and seeing sort of the political end of this stuff, the idea is that government shouldn't pick winners and losers, but everything the Koch brothers does in terms of the way they interact with government is about making sure that they get picked the winner. Is that tension? I mean, do you see that tension in your reporting?
So, I mean, that tension is everywhere. When you get down to the real deal, the business, how Koch makes their fortune, the politics breaks apart immediately. And my brain is racing with examples right now. First of all, I would like to say that Koch and other companies really celebrate the fracking revolution. You know, hydraulic fracturing that has unleashed all these crude oil and natural gas supplies, seen as sort of the savior of the free market. Fracking was created by the United States federal government. Fracking was a ward of the state for decades. It was kept alive through massive tax subsidies. The government did the basic research. There were public-private partnerships at universities that figured out how to do fracking, and it was the private people that kind of came in at the end and commercialized it. So talk about picking winners and losers. Fracking only exists because of the U.S. taxpayer, but when taxpayers want to subsidize solar, wind, or other renewable energies, now it's crony capitalism. But the other example that comes to my mind is that Koch's bread and butter for decades has been oil refining, okay? And that business is so deeply enmeshed with the government, with subsidies, that there's no disentangling it. And I want to point out that oil refining is tremendously anti-competitive today. And one of the reasons, strangely enough, is the Clean Air Act. You know, the United States passed this clean air regulation back in the 70s. And we have not built a new oil refinery in the country since that time because the existing oil refineries, and this is all proven in the book, the existing oil refineries gamed the system. They gamed the regulatory system so that they could stay in business and basically block any new entrants through clean air regulations. What I'm saying is Koch's business benefits from government subsidies, government regulations, believe it or not, and the company wins because it is the entrenched status quo player in a lot of these businesses. So yes, I mean, it's not even like hypocritical. When you get down to the ground level, you just see that this is a firm operating deeply enmeshed with government programs all the time.
Well, how do they, I mean, to the extent that, and I know that you sat down with Charles, I think, to the extent that, I mean, how do they respond to that? Like, I mean, how do they respond to that notion of, because they've explicitly said, you know, government should not be supporting solar energy and government should not be, you know, supporting wind energy. They should live or die in the marketplace. And I would add, not only did the U.S. government essentially build fracking, but for a long time, and maybe it still exists statutorily, things like You don't have to reveal what's in your fracking fluid, so folks randomly test for stuff to see if their drinking water contains, you know, chemicals that shouldn't be there, which is a lot harder than people, I think, probably imagine. But how do they respond to that? Tension is not really... It's only tension insofar as there's a pretense to this, right? I mean, it's not tense if you just say like, we go out and pretend like we don't want government influence and stuff because it's all working just for us.
Here's how I would answer that. Here's how I think they respond. I put basically that question to Philip Ellender, the top lobbyist at Koch Industries. I was sitting interviewing him in their lobbying office a block from the White House in D.C. What he says to me is, you know, Chris, we don't have to be happy with the game, but we're going to play by the rules of the game. So if they're going to give us subsidies, we're going to take the subsidies, because if we didn't, that would be like playing basketball and not taking 3 points because you disagree with the three-point rule. We're not going to do that. Well, okay, so there's an answer for you from Koch Industries. It does reflect the advantages of being the incumbent, and I can't emphasize enough, when I look out at the political landscape, you see this bitter, bitter, bitter dispute between the blue team and the red team, the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, no holds barred, bitter dispute during the Obama era, particularly now during Trump, that leaves the government essentially handicapped, can't do anything. Well, in an environment where the government can't do anything, the entities that win every day are the entrenched incumbent players, the biggest of the big corporations that benefit from the status quo, and that's Coke. So Coke can get up and legitimately say we are opposed to subsidies. Don't give subsidies to ethanol. Don't give subsidies to wind power. What they just don't have to bring up is the massive programs underlying their existing business as it exists today. So you can just sort of let that stuff go and continue to benefit from it. That's sort of how I think it works today.
Did their perspective evolve as they, I mean, because they weren't, you know, 30 years ago, or were they, were they similarly situated?
They were, I think. I mean, from the very beginning in the 60s, oil refining, oil trading, oil processing, the fossil fuels business has been the bedrock of this company. Now, they've diversified dramatically. They own Georgia Pacific. They're the third biggest nitrogen fertilizer company on planet Earth. They've grown a lot. And in fact, I mean, we can get into this, but I describe them as like a giant private equity firm now. They're just a big pool of cash looking to invest itself constantly to earn profits. But you can't deny at the heart of it is the fossil fuel business, and then more broadly, these really complex, really expensive businesses that are at the foundation of modern civilization. Fuel, fertilizer, clothing material, building material, the sensors and electronics. Coke specializes in those kinds of business, and they have from the beginning. And also, I would say from the beginning, Charles Koch has had his very firm anti-government views that he's been pushing for. And it illustrates itself in get the government out of our business, you know, fewer regulations, lower taxes, no regulations on greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. That's how it tends to exhibit itself.
All right. So let's talk about this dynamic of the company being private, because there was opportunities for them to go public, to make a big sort of payout early on, and then presumably, you know, follow the way that it, and they didn't. And that allowed them what exactly?
Well, so it's very important. I mean, the book opens in 1981 when these bankers from Morgan Stanley come to Wichita and they try to convince Charles Koch to go public, which was conventional wisdom. Go public, sell shares on Wall Street, make a lot of money. Charles Koch turned them down flat, turned down a $23 million payday that he would have gotten. And, you know, today that's like $60 million. Staying private did a lot of key things. Again, Charles Koch has had a very specific vision of how to run this company and, frankly, how to run the country from the very beginning. And by staying private, he did a few important things. The first is that he is not beholden to outside shareholders. So Charles Koch can control the company and make all the key decisions, as he does. But secondly, he's not enslaved to these short-term incentives that most public companies are. I mean, I've seen this. I've covered public companies for decades, and they're obsessed with the next 3 months. What's the next quarterly earnings going to be? Charles Koch doesn't have to worry about that. The company and the people who run it is thinking about the world in a time frame of 2, 5, even 10 years out. I mean, that's the chess game they're playing. It's measured in years and decades. They don't care about quarters. And, you know, interestingly, when he decided not to go public, I got the memo that these bankers wrote when they got back home. And Charles Koch told them, if we go public, people are going to figure out how much money our commodities traders make. And if they figure out how much money we're making, they're going to stop trading with us. That, to me, illuminates why this company is so secretive. Their whole strategy is to simply know more about the world than anybody else and to trade off that knowledge and to gain. And when that's your line of work, you don't want other people to know what you know or know what you're about to do. And that's one of the big reasons they're so secretive.
And I will say that there is a sort of a lesson there for what ails much of corporate America, at least or one element of it, is that short-term thinking, right? Like, because the Koch brothers were so intimately tied to the long-term success of their company that they were not making decisions that most CEOs would, who are simply tied to their own compensation package, which is tied to stock options, which is a function of short-term profit margins that could come in simply by cutting workers.
No doubt about it. And this book, if anything, it's a case study in long-term strategic thinking. And I think long-term strategic thinking is actually in desperately short supply today. So let's, you know, whether you agree with the Koch brothers or not, whether you hate their business or love their business, it is instructive to watch how they think and to watch what they've done over the decades. And I could walk through a million examples. I'll just give you two. I mean, in 2003, these fertilizer plants had gone belly up in the Midwest, big, big plants that were losing millions of dollars a year. Nobody wanted to buy them. Koch quietly swooped in, bought these things at bankruptcy option, because Charles Koch knew people were still going to eat, they were still going to need fertilizer, energy markets were going to stabilize and change. He was playing a game on a level of years, snapped these things up for pennies on a dollar. Now they're one of the most profitable pillars of the company. The second thing I want to say is that this strategy, this approach, applies equally to politics. I got a copy of a speech that Charles Koch gave in 1974, where he lays out a political playbook of how he wants to make America more libertarian. And it is really stunning the level of patience and discipline that Koch used over decades and stuck with that playbook. I mean, that was the blueprint that they still enforce today. It wasn't just we're going to hire a bunch of lobbyists. It was we're going to fund thinkers, universities. We're going to use litigation. We're going to use corporate lobbying. On and on, and they stuck with the plan. So it really is an example of long-term strategy.
I would add, in terms of that fertilizer thing, I would imagine the irony is that fertilizer obviously becomes far more essential, not maybe far more, but significantly more essential in an era of climate change where growing conditions are that much more difficult across the board. And they certainly have done their part to slow down, to stop, put off progress in dealing with climate change. Talk about, I started by saying that Jane Mayer said that your book basically lays to rest any, you know, sort of doubt as to the incredibly outsized role the Koch brothers have played in creating the climate science denial movement. I mean, I don't know how else you refer to that, but
I think that's exactly how you refer to it. Yeah.
Well, walk us through that. How did they do that, and when?
Yeah, and let me tell you why I'm even reporting on it. I wanted to know how Koch lobbies. I'm super interested in the whole topic of how do corporations win in Washington. It's no doubt about it. They are winning more often than they're losing today, and they're writing our public policy. So I wanted to know, what does Koch do? How do they do it? What are they doing right? Why are they so powerful in Washington? And when I started interviewing these lobbyists at the company and the political operatives, they pointed me in one direction. I remember asking this guy, what was important to you? What did you lobby on? What woke you up in the morning? And the answer to that question was carbon. The issue of carbon was of paramount importance to Koch's political machine. What they're saying is that, you know, Koch as a fossil fuels maker is just deeply enmeshed with the fossil fuel system, which is categorically putting gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions into the sky every year for free. It's not considered a pollutant, really. So if you put a price on those emissions, as many people around the world want to do, because we realize, you know, the costs of doing this are going to be enormous. I know that that seems like stating the obvious, but I just can't overemphasize it enough. But Koch realized really decades ago that if we limit greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to put a cap on the future of the fossil fuels business. And that is going to cost Koch at least billions of dollars. I mean, think about the amount of money they have sunk into these enormous refineries, pipeline networks, global energy trading systems. If we put a cap on carbon, the value of all those things decline. And so I'm sorry to go on so long about this, but how did they do it? I mean, they employed that 360-degree Koch political machine I've kind of referred to here. They funded think tank studies that made it look like it would be absolutely awful if we regulated greenhouse gas emissions. They hired their lobbyists to figure out who the vulnerable lawmakers were. When the Tea Party came along in 2010, Koch was there as a concierge, basically, to the Tea Party. They helped the Tea Party organize events. They chartered buses to take the Tea Party members for free from wherever they live to Washington, D.C. And as they did that, Koch injected its own rhetoric and its own concerns into the Tea Party. When it would host a big rally, the people would get up on stage and tell the crowd, hey, if we regulate greenhouse gas emissions, that's the first face of government tyranny. You know, this is what Thomas Jefferson warned us against, is that if you regulate greenhouse gas emissions, the government is going to turn socialist. So they harnessed that populist energy and helped derail a bill that was frankly a Republican bill, a conservative right. bill that involved trading, and they derailed it in 2010.
And I imagine, too, that they're, you know, they're like so much of like when I think of, you know, because this has come back in the news, the light bulb controversy. You know, this was, it's hard for me to express to younger people in my office, like the idea that, and this came up under Bush, actually, the idea that we would legislate as to, you know, incandescent light bulbs as constructed now are going to be, legislated out of existence was literally like, I don't know, we were sucking the personalities out of people out of the back of their heads and we were going to drain them of all their bodily fluids. And I imagine on some level, like the Koch brothers understood that if we fund that stuff, that is just upstream from all the other stuff.
Yes. And I must emphasize what a threat that is to the fossil fuels business. It is pretty remarkable. 10 years ago, there's a lot of conversation about, quote, unquote, peak supply of oil. Oh, my God, we're going to run out of oil.
Right.
There'll be all these. Okay. The threat now, and this is real. You talk to these oil industry investors and analysts, it's peak demand. They realize that the alternatives are getting cheaper. The costs of greenhouse gases are becoming more apparent. And so we might shift, and demand for oil will drop. That is a catastrophic outcome for these big fossil fuels companies. And, yes, they do realize that these things are going to chip away at the armor of, frankly, the massive monopoly the fossil fuels have over the energy system.
Interesting. Let's just talk about a little bit of the work that they have done in attacking and demonizing unions. And we should also say that, I mean, it's interesting because you give them, they apparently were pioneers in this. And I want to start with this, the way they track their warehouse employees. Cause I spoke, I interviewed a woman who had spent some time working at Amazon and had talked about this, that happens there, that they the tracking of employees at literally every 60 seconds they have to clock into the thing. That many of that dynamic was in many ways pioneered by the Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers practiced this to the hilt, and I am so grateful you brought this up. It's a huge part of the story that surprised me with how important it is. And gosh, you look at the history of it. You know, back when Charles Koch took over his company, 33% of Americans in the private sector workforce were in a labor union. That had an enormous effect on the entire economy, because even non-union shops, the owners were scared that the workers would unionize. This was the era in America that stands apart as the time when we had economic growth, people gained. You know, we're ending now about a decade of economic expansion, and the vast majority of Americans have not even advanced one bit economically, okay? They're taking on debt. Their wages haven't significantly increased. That's not how things were. The book shows labor unions had their problems. We've got to be real honest about that. They used intimidation. They used violence. There was corruption. Okay, that's real. But let's look at what life is like today. You know, and I spent years reporting on Koch's factories where these labor unions are being beaten back and taken apart. You brought up a perfect example. Without the labor unions being powerful, Koch dictates what the work life is like. And these employees at this warehouse, in particular in Portland, spend 10 hours a day being told what to do by the minute by this software system. But even worse, a few years ago, Koch would publicly post the employee's performance as tracked by the software system. And so it literally, you know, divided and conquered the workforce by making them compete against each other every week. And the low performers on that chart would be disciplined or fired. So they're systematically dividing workers against each other. And I got the labor union contracts for these employees going back to the 70s, and it shows they're earning less money today than they did in the 1980s when you adjust for inflation. So they're working harder, they're getting paid less, and that's really the story of the American worker today. And Koch reflects that, and it also drives that. I mean, they've been working across the country to dismantle and disempower labor unions for decades, and it's been working.
So David has died. Recently, mm-hmm. He was you write of him as being the more public of the billionaires. Charles is the one who stayed back in Kansas, I guess it was, and continues to get up early and, you know, work the grind. But he is in his 80s, if I'm not mistaken. What happens to the business and to, I guess, you talk about how at one point they had suffered a lot of fines from the EPA because they were dumping stuff and they didn't care. And then they realized, like, this is too expensive. We're better off spending the money up front and changing society so that we don't get fines because we now have tailored the regulatory state to just suit the way that we do business. What happens to this machine, both the sort of the, to the extent that one can delineate between the political and corporate, which it seems like one really can't, but right. What happens to this machine after Charles dies, let's say?
And I think you're right. You cannot delineate. The politics and the business are tied up together. And look, this is unsatisfying, but as a reporter, I just have to tell you, I don't know. It is a huge open question mark what happens when Charles Koch leaves. He's in his early 80s. He, as you've mentioned, I firmly believe Charles Koch is the center of this story. I mean, he drove this organization. David Koch, while he was more public, was more of a silent partner. Charles Koch is a meticulous planner. I mean, this is a guy with 3 engineering graduate degrees from MIT. He doesn't leave stuff to chance. So if anybody's thinking hard about the future of this organization, it's Charles Koch. The end of the book has a chapter about Charles Koch's son, Chase, who's been really cultivated to take over the company and the political network, I believe, since he was a kid, since he was 7. Furthermore, I think Charles Koch would argue that he's basically institutionalized his view inside the corporation through this very detailed philosophy he has called market-based management, which is taught to every single Coke employee when they start for days. And I've never seen anything like it. I mean, Coke employees literally speak their own vocabulary that has a special meaning to them. It's one of the reasons I call the book Cokeland. It's like its own little world. So Charles Koch would say that even when he steps away, his instincts and his strategies have been institutionally baked into this organization. Now, I just have to be honest, it's an open question. Is Chase Koch going to be different from his dad? Is the company going to drift without this leader at the helm? Only time will tell, but it is absolutely guaranteed that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, this institution is going to be just as large and just as influential as it is today. It's just so big. It's so embedded in our economic and political system that it's not going away.
The book is Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. Christopher Leonard, thanks so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. There you have it. I don't know. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but I loved the idea of they always think it's embedded in their institution. They always think it's going to outlive them. And then the sands of time wipe it all away. One can only hope.
Yeah.
People start working on that Chaz guy right now. Chase Chaz. I'm sure he calls himself Chaz. I'm almost sure of it.
I'm worried about Wyatt.
Wait, is he one of the Coke?
He's this, some like son. Yeah.
He's the maker of the shirt you should have been wearing.
Yeah, no, I know.
Interview.
I know I should have been
shirt
wearing
that's,
that one.
Oh, yeah, damn.
Damn it. I'm looking at it right now. Looking at it.
Actually,
right
especially
now.
After that interview, I feel like Wyatt, we should just cut some slack.
Right.
Oh, we got to nip
that's
up
just
the
best
moron
case.
In Florida.
If the entire family basically said, I'm just going to follow my passion. Yeah. One guy's like, I have a vision for baked goods. Another guy have a vision for a clothing line. Another guy like, I'm going to raise, you know, Arabian horses or something.
Oh, no. Nothing that involves the care of a living being.
Well, that's probably true.
If you look at the production value on those shirts, let's stick to like pottery.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe. How about a nursery? High-end nursery.
Ooh, yes. No. Bad deal. Not a good deal.
Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. And you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content every day. Did we release the Hannity thing?
No, me and Brennan have something to clear up then, I guess.
No comment.
We're going to. We're just going to drop it out. We'll drop it on the feed today.
Yeah, we can easily do it.
It'll be in the members feed.
We'll see.
But not only do you get deep archives, deep archive of the week, we'll do that. And we're going to start doing that this week.
In a certain sense.
Right.
Just hang tight.
But you also get extra content every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off of all the coffee blends. Get the Majority Report blend. It's a nice cup of joe, as it were. Also, AM Quickie every morning. People are loving it. Actually, I got honked at by somebody in a car today.
Wow.
They said, Sam, big fan.
Love the quickie.
They didn't say, I love the quickie.
I
Man,
was going to say.
Quickie's so good.
I sort of felt like
it's
I heard that they were going to say
digestible news content.
There was something
that still
about.
That has a point of view.
There was something about the way that they said that I thought that.
I had no idea.
It was awkward. It was on Flatbush. And the guy was going up. I was walking down the downside, and I'm walking next to some lady, and the guy starts yelling at me, and she's just looking like she has no idea what's going on.
And he's like, excited about it starting its own new feed.
Yep.
Yeah.
When's the new feed happening? Just tell me.
Honey, he's Soon. About to launch it Soon. On the new feed. Is that the guy that was on Sex and the City? Yes.
Yep, there it is. also, folks, just a reminder. This episode is brought to you by Blinkist. You know, honestly, during the interview, I was going to say, like, I was going to say to the guy, you should do a small book on market-based management, because that's something that I would go to Blinkist. I wouldn't read the whole book because I'm not that, but I want interested in the principles just to get a sense of how they're operating.
Right.
And Blinkist would be the perfect way to digest that.
Coke management.
And I just thought that was not the appropriate way to approach that interview.
I don't think so.
My understanding of market-based management is kind of like, don't be diligent in inspecting pipelines.
Right.
Right. Be very diligent, and when your employees use the bathroom.
That's the exactly. That is sort of like the extension of Michael's business theory, which is don't get good at a job you don't want to do. The Blinkist app.
Oh, that's smart. It's been very effective.
Patreon.com/TMBS, baby. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down just to 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people. 10 million are using Blinkist right now, right this moment.
So good.
Has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books. That's true. I don't even know if they had history books when I started Blinkisting. Coined.
Do you have to
trademark.
Civil War?
Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist. 25% off your first year? At Blinkist.com/majority. Check it out. Blinkist.com/majority. Michael.
Yes.
Tomorrow's indeed. Tuesday.
Tomorrow's Tuesday. Kianga Amada Taylor joins us. We're talking about the tension and potential really reinventing the conversation between reform and revolution, how that fits into the Bernie Sanders campaign. And we also might be touching on the Kambiki Women's Collective as well. Kambiki Collective. Then Bhaskar Sunkara and Napoleon the Legend join us, both in studio. We're talking about the legacy of Robert Mugabe, throwback to Christopher Hitchens on socialism in the 1980s, and the state of the 2020 race and the coalitions the different candidates are assembling, plus, of course, a whole bunch more than that, as always. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, where we've just cracked our first 74,000 subscribers. Thank you.
Check out the Antifada, patreon.com, the Antifada. Matt.
Are you familiar with passenger pigeons?
Passenger pigeons.
They're sort of the East Coast version of bison in that they were hunted to extinction early on, but they're like these big, giant pigeons with like colorful necks and stuff.
What?
And they accounted for like a sixth or something crazy of North American birds in the early colonial time. They would fly in massive flocks and basically blot out the sun for multiple days and things like that. And
what? No, I hadn't heard of anything like this.
You might want to look at those.
They just
I feel like Saul should be on that. My son would be on top of that type of stuff.
It was really like biblical sort of thing. And then we massacred them all. Well, of course. James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, that massacre is illustrated in one of the chapters where the newly appointed sheriff dusts off some old military equipment and shoots a cannon into the giant flock of them. And it's basically a book that meditates on conservationism versus, commodifying the country in terms of settlement and things like that. So it's an interesting, very interesting book. And The Passenger Pigeon was something I learned about from it.
I had no idea. Fascinating. Check it out, folks. All right. See you. Fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiot.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.